And welcome to Liberating Libraries, a project by the Conspiracy of Equality. My name is Caitlin.
And my name is Blake. If you would like to know more about Liberating Libraries and the Conspiracy of Equality, you should check out our website at liberatinglibraries.org. So today is part two.
Part two. Our two-part series authors that the other one doesn't like.
That is a really terrible title. We have to think of a better title.
We do. We will have a better title before we actually release this.
Okay. That's good. So what's happening today?
So today I am interviewing you about one of these authors that you really, really like, John Steinbeck.
That's true. So John Steinbeck is an author. He won the Nobel Prize. I believe it was in 62 or 63. He was born in like the early 1900s. In a middle-class family in California. He kind of lived in the 20s as just trying to make his way through kind of like through journalism and traveling the country. And then in the 1930s, he really started to gain some success in writing. He's most well-known for The Grapes of Wrath, which was published in 1938, which was a huge success and told the story of the Oklahomans coming to California in the 1930s and the exploitation and struggles that they faced. So that was his first like super popular novel, the one that really secured his place in kind of great American literature. And yeah, like he is a writer who kind of kept the same themes throughout his life. He writes about the working class, he writes about agricultural workers. And he writes kind of about the conflict between workers and bosses in kind of various different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why are you drawn to Steinbeck?
Steinbeck was one of the few authors that I read as a teenager when I didn't really read. Mm-hmm. My mom liked him, and so there was always a few kind of Steinbeck books in our library. And I remember The Pearl was the first one I read by him that was like really good. I just remember reading it, and it hadn't been anything like I'd read in high school up to that point. And it was exciting and interesting and sad. I didn't get all the themes at the time, but like it's just something that stuck with me. And then like as I started rereading again in my late 20s and early 30s, I just became to really appreciate the fact that Steinbeck was explicitly telling stories about the working class. He was coming from it from a political analysis of like workers and communities and the ways in which like bosses and capitalism kind of destroys these communities, and the ways in which workers have to constantly fight to both fight the boss but also fight to kind of like maintain their own relationships and their own kind of like personal humanities. Besides that, he's a really easy author to read. Like, he is very much like, what's the cheesy line? Show, don't tell. Mm-hmm. Like, he is textbook in that, like, his sentences are always very, very simple sentences. He's not a complex writer. So it's just like, you sit down with a Steinbeck and you just get drawn into the story. Like the writing is not almost there. Like, it's just like you just draws you into the book, and like you can sit down and be like, oh, I'm gonna read for 20 minutes, and next thing you know, you're 100 pages into the book, and you're just like, I don't know what happened right there. Like, I thought I had just finished one chapter. Mm-hmm. So, in that sense, that's also one of the reasons why I really like Steinbeck.
So, what would you say Steinbeck does for you politically?
I think what he does for me politically is kind of what I kind of had just mentioned. He, by telling those stories of workers and telling those stories of kind of community, it's trying to build something that doesn't necessarily exist. It's trying to imagine a way out of different worlds, right? So like Tortilla Flats, which was one of his early books, and it was one of the first ones that kind of like put his name out there. It's a story about basically like what we'd call like just drunks and layabouts, but it tells their story, and it tells their story in a way that's very humanizing. and kind of like end their own kind of struggles to just live the life that they want to live. And I just think that he does just something really interesting, because he takes this group of people that, like, if you read other writers about it, like, they want to moralize about it, or they want to show how, like, what they're doing is against the grain, and, like, you know, they should try to bring them into wanting to live these middle-class lives. And Steinbeck is just okay with just letting them be who they are, and just letting them, like, be these people. And, like, even though they're not, you know, even though they're outside of the norm, they're just folks who are living their life, and they're not causing anybody harm. And in fact, they're actually, like, creating community, really strong support communities for these desperately poor people in ways that, yeah, like, we just couldn't imagine if we only focused our lives as, you know, trying to think about bringing people into this sort of middle-class lifestyle. Or, like, not necessarily middle-class lifestyle, because that didn't really exist while he was writing, but, like, into this very normal, you know, work, get married, have children, you know, type of lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. I remember you talking a bit about, like, about the way that he writes about all kinds of different workers, including sex workers, mm-hmm. and how you thought that was, like, really important, the way that he does that.
So again, within Tortilla Flats and then in Cannery Row, they're kind of about similar groups of people. But, like, yeah, like, in his books, like, sex workers are people, and they're workers, and he doesn't spend a lot of time moralizing about this. Like I think you can definitely hear sort of some of that, like, stereotype leftist of, like, people are only in sex work because of capitalism. Mm. But, like, at the same time, he's very sympathetic to them. They're people, they're characters. Like, he understands the role that they play in helping develop this community and, like, supporting, like, other people in this community. And, like, you know, besides just the sex work, the actual emotional labor that they do to help, you know, bring everybody up. So, yeah, it's giving voice to these workers in ways that, like, I'm not necessarily sure does, like happens, at least in the 1930s, with a few exceptions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I mean, so, going back with Tortilla Flats, like, I think one of the other interesting things about Steinbeck is, after that book was released and got, like, had some fame, he was really, really upset with the way that the book was being taken up. Because people were just looking at these people as, oh, well, they're just drunks and layabouts. So, like, you know, this is a fun, silly story. But, like, ultimately, like, they're not doing anything. Like, they're not being providing to society. Mm-hmm. And he got so angry with the way that this was taken up that in the late 30s, when it was being re-released, he actually wrote a prelude to this book that, like, basically condemned sort of that type of reading of this book. Hmm. And, like, was just like, no, you need to understand this book as these are people's lives, and this is the life that they are choosing to do, and we have to be okay with that. Like, not necessarily be okay with that, but, like, this is just about who they are. Like, we don't need to moralize about this. Mm-hmm. Which I think is just so interesting to, like, to think in that way.
Yeah, and, like, I've heard you talk a bit about how Steinbeck's been taken up, and, like, the only Steinbeck that I've read is The Grapes of Wrath, but one of the things that really struck me when I was reading it was how different it is from the movie, and how the film The Grapes of Wrath, like, if you've seen it, I'm telling you right now, that's not how the book goes. And in particular, the way that the politics is stripped out of the movie. And I don't know, is that something that happened to his other work? Is it something that he commented on?
Not that I'm aware of. So, yes. So, like, Grapes of Wrath and In Dubious Battle are the two most explicitly political pieces of his writing. And those were, like, two of the three sort of Great Depression trilogy, like, thematic trilogy that he wrote. And, like, they're unquestionably political. Like, In Dubious Battle follows two communist organizers in, like, the fields. Mm-hmm. In the fields, and I think it's in Oregon, is that one is set. So, like, I think that politics, that the explicitness of that politics does fall away. Like, I don't see it in any of the other writings that I have. Like, I haven't read everything by him, but I think I've read just about all of kind of the other big ones. So, like, I think that explicitness falls away, but the idea of kind of workers in community in the face of constant pressure from bosses doesn't die.
So one of the other things that that we've talked about with Steinbeck is that he writes a lot about place, and that place, like, and land are really, really important to Steinbeck. So I'm just wondering, why do you think that's important in his work, and what does it do?
Place is extremely important in Steinbeck. A lot of his novels are placed in California, where he kind of grew up, where he grew up, had his childhood, and spent a good portion of his life, though not all of it. And, like, I think for Steinbeck, because he's writing in the 30s, right? Like, that's when he started to write. And, like, if you kind of, you know, trace the broad history of the United States, it's, like, it's kind of considered the 30s as where the original American dream died. So, the original, like, the way I've been taught what the kind of this American dream was that, like, there was always the West, and there was always land. So if you were an immigrant worker in, you know, New York City, and you didn't like your life, you could always just go out West and get a piece of land and be able to build from there. Whereas, kind of, again, the story that I've been told is that the 30s is where this idea died, because you had this wave of workers coming West, but they couldn't find any land anymore. So it's just like this idea that you had this freedom in the sense that you could leave your bosses and go become your own boss by being your own farmer was dead. So I think Steinbeck is trying to grapple with that initially. Like, he's trying to grapple with this idea that, like, land isn't there anymore. That freedom that we were told people had in land is gone. So I think that's part of why he finds it so important. But, like, he also talks about agricultural workers, and, like, you cannot remove sort of land from agricultural workers, right? Like, obviously, because that's what they're doing. They're on the land every day, like, working it with their hands. And then kind of the other piece is land isn't also passive in his stories, right? Like, the land changes. The land, you know, bursts with life when it rains and then dies when during droughts. And, like, that's really important for his stories. Like, so in East of Eden, like, that's entirely what the story is set in. It's just, like, there's the poor family who has land up at the top, who has really shit land. And then you have this rich farmer down at the bottom of the land where it's really fertile. And, like, the ways in which kind of, like, the cycles of drought and a plenty happen, like, impact all of these families, impact the families in different ways. And so, like, the ways in which that impacts, like, it, like, the land is alive. The land is very much there. And I'll just read a little section from Steinbeck as well, from The Wayward Bus. And, like, the premise of this book is there's a bus driver who's trying to get this group of odd collection of passengers to their point. However, there's a pinch that there's a rickety old bridge that they have to go over, and there's been days of really, really heavy rain. So, he has walked to this wooden bridge to go see if it's still passable. They walk together out on the wooden bridge, and the moment Juan stopped on the flooring, he could feel the thrumming vibration of the water. The bridge shivered and trembled, and there was a deep hum in the timbers that was louder than the rush of the water. Juan looked over the side of the bridge. The supporting timbers were underwater, and the river foamed and bubbled under it. And the whole bridge trembled and panted. And there were little strained cries from the timbers where the iron turn bolts went through, as they watched a great old live oak tree come rolling heavily down the stream. When it struck the bridge and turned, the whole structure cried out and seemed to brace itself. The tree caught in the submerged underpinning, and there came a shrill, ripping sound from under the bridge. The two men moved quickly back off the bridgehead. This story does not exist without the land, without a storm coming and flooding this bridge, flooding this river, making the other roadway just mud and muck. It doesn't exist without that story, without the land there. Mm-hmm. So the land is an active character in here that people have to figure out ways to negotiate. And so, like, when you're on the land, there's nothing more than the land.
Yeah. So what do you think is the difference between, like, Steinbeck's approach and, like, what it does for us politically in the sense of the land not being passive? What's the difference between what Steinbeck is doing and then what sort of the Manifest Destiny, like, great American stories of the land do in talking about the land as, and the people who lived there as, like, the wild west to be tamed by the civilization that America was bringing us? Like, what's Steinbeck doing that's different?
So I'll be honest, I haven't read a whole lot of that one. So, like, I can't, like, necessarily give specific examples. I think, obviously, one of the major critiques of Steinbeck is, despite the fact that his novels take place in California, like, indigenous people, the people that were still there and were there first, like, are very much the passive, the Thomas King, the dead Indians, right?
Or the dying Indian, right?
I think the Steinbeck is just, like, they were straight up dead Indians. Like, right. They did not exist anymore. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they're there, they've already been cleared off. So now it's the turn of the settlers to come in. So it's because I think it's being set a little bit after necessarily kind of the great American novels that you are, correct me if I'm wrong, that, like, that conflict in Steinbeck's eyes is already gone, is already done.
But there's also something about, you know, like, the go west young man kind of mm-hmm. vision of America, right? Like, that was still popular at that time and, like, remained popular in the 50s when people were like, go to California and buy, like, middle-class Americans, go to California and buy land and get your pool and your big house and all of that stuff. Like, there's a way that the idea of America incorporates an idea about land, but I think what you're saying is that Steinbeck's way of talking about the land is different than that.
Mm-hmm. So, like, I think, like, so, like, in that sense, like, the go west, it's like, I think it's still even an attempt to try to bring back that, like, the idea of freedom of the west into something really commodified, that, like you can have your freedom with your swimming pool, though that's not freedom, right? Mm-hmm. Like, whereas, like, the original freedom of, like, actually owning your own piece of land that you could work and turn into money to, like, provide for yourself and make yourself into that living are very different ways of seeing and understanding land. So, like, in that, in, like, the pool and sort of, like, go west in this way, it's like land is nothing but a commodity. It is nothing for a commodity for you to feel pleasure. Mm. Whereas I think for Steinbeck, he's looking at the loss of land as a way to sustain yourself and a way to sustain your community.
So, like you're saying, like, Steinbeck really wants to write this story of the great American novel. Like, he wants to write the quote-unquote great American novel. And you're already kind of talking about it, but are there other things that you want to, like, say about, like, some of the good things and maybe some of the limitations about his view of America and, like, what he's trying to pull out in his writing about America?
Like, I think I'm a very, like, optimistic view of Steinbeck when I read his stuff, because I do really like it. Like, I think there are obvious limitations in the idea of the great American novel. Like, mm-hmm. kind of like the ways in which certain histories have to be written. So, like, it's almost like the great American novel can't be a story about, like, indigenous genocide.
Or slavery.
Or slavery. So, like, there are limitations in this idea that, like, these grand narratives of America. What I think Steinbeck does, which is different in that, is that he tries to tell the other story of America. He tries to sell the story that's not pretty. Mm. The story of struggle, the story of exploitation. Which I don't know. I don't know if other writers try to do that. And I mean, I also find Steinbeck kind of contradictory, that I really like him so much, because I really don't like the classics, like classic literature or like really literature before like 1950. I just generally I find really frustrating.
Bold statements.
I know, bold statements. Bold, you know, very broad
statements. Sweeping generalization. But I mean, Steinbeck isn't Hemingway, and Steinbeck isn't Faulkner, and Steinbeck isn't like those kind of American writers. Mm-hmm. Like Steinbeck is a very unique American author, or he was at least at the time that he was writing.
Yeah, and I mean, and he was blacklisted, right, too, right? Because he was, like, his books were sympathetic to communist ideals, and, like, just they didn't fit nice and pretty into the idea of the Great American Novel. Like, he got huge backlash, like, throughout his entire writing career, where, like, critics would savage, like, everything that he was saying for no particular reason. Mm. But, like, it was believed because it was just, like, this was the time where writers got blacklisted, and like everybody thought that he was a communist because he was sympathetic to the stories of workers and workers' struggles and that the bosses are bad.
So here's a question. Do you think that there's value in contemporary organizers, particularly organizers of workers, reading Steinbeck?
Yes, but kind of like when I was sort of in my undergrad and maybe in my master's, everybody, like all of the socialists that I knew, were saying, read Steinbeck, read In Dubious Battle, it's his greatest book, and blah, blah, blah. So, In Dubious Battle is about two communist organizers who go to the apple orchards, I think of Oregon or Washington, to organize a strike. And that's what they do. And that is what the book is about. And it's about the ways in which, like, these workers are getting screwed, as well as about how organized the bosses are to, like, make sure they try to break the strike. So it's a fun read. I don't know how you can read that book and not be very, very cynical to think that this is how revolution or how strikes could happen. Because he's telling it from the perspective of the Communist Party members. It's just like, it's very patronizing to the workers. It's completely workers only think in groupthink, that there is no like individual desires or needs, that the workers are kind of just like lumbering fools who just want to fight each other, which is I find really frustrating. And I also find it frustrating that people were just like, you have to read this book, as it's the greatest book in the world. But at the same time, like, I think Steinbeck does give something that I don't know if I've really necessarily read all other writers do, which is give voice creatively to worker struggles in ways that are, number one, good, that are like exciting to read, that are interesting to read, that like are dynamic, that, you know, like the struggle with the boss sometimes isn't always everything. Like, maybe there are other things happening in people's lives, or like workers who want to go off and try to do something else because they're actually not happy here. Like all of that goes in there. So I think Steinbeck is useful to a point, right? Like, I think Steinbeck offers us a way of thinking about working class community and like the ways in which it can be done. As well as he talks about agricultural workers.
Yeah.
Which is also a good thing, too, who get written out of a lot of, you know, quote-unquote left or socialist sort of literature.
Or even workers' histories that focus on industrial workers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think there is. I just think it's not straightforward. You need to read other things as well to get a full of things. And I mean, Steinbeck is writing about the white working class, too, right? So, like, you need to find these stories that also talk about workers of color, that talk about women, that talk about colonialism and talk about slavery. And, like, he didn't. So, like, that doesn't mean we throw out his books, but it's just, like, he can only be one piece. Mm-hmm. And you need to read other stuff as well.
Yeah. So, then if you were going to recommend some Steinbeck to somebody who's never read any, what would you recommend?
So, I'm not going to recommend Greats of Wrath because that's the book everyone recommends. So I would actually put The Pearl and Cannery Row, I think, is the ones that I would recommend. They're both shorter novels by him. Like, The Pearl is essentially a novella. And they're just both simple stories. Yeah, they're just simple stories about, like The Pearl is about a fisherman who finds a pearl and is trying to sell it, but, like, nobody is, like, giving him a fair price for it. Cannery Row is just about people, like, just folks who want to celebrate this doctor who helps everybody in the community and their spectacular failures in their ability or inability to do this. And I just think they're both good stories that illuminate different things that just offer a better way to see the world that we don't necessarily get elsewhere.
All right, so that's the end of part two of our interviews about authors that the other one doesn't like, the name of which we are changing.
Yes, thank you so much for listening. What's next? Do we have a next yet?
I think we're hypothetically planning to do another book-specific episode, and then doing into our magnum opus land episode that we have planned for this year, which is
the one that we've been talking about. I think this is the third podcast now that we've possibly talked about, and we still haven't got there. So it's got to be good, is what's happening right now.
But I think we've got a couple ideas, maybe talking about some Isabel Allende, maybe talking about some people who are problematic but still worth reading.
Yeah, some stories about Scarborough, maybe.
Yeah, stuff like that. But in the meantime, you can check out all of their old episodes on libertinglibraries.org, and we'll talk to you next time.
See you later.
Music for this podcast is by Ketza from their album Metamorphosis. You can find them at the Free Music Archive or at ketzamusic.com. Hi, and welcome to Liberating Libraries, a project by the Conspiracy of Equality. My name is Caitlin.
And my name is Blake. And today is...
No.
Oh. And my name is Blake. And if you want to know more about the Conspiracy of Equality and Liberating Libraries, you can check out our website. Liberatinglibraries.org. What is our website?